You are listening to Development Dialogues, a podcast series from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, exploring new thinking on development through entrepreneurship, innovation, and market-driven economic growth. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes U.
I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreyer Chair here at CSIS, and I'm here with my friend Betsy Bassin, who's the CEO of the Pangora Group. And Betsy and I are going to be having a conversation today about local capacity building as part of our initiative that we're working on around the principles of development dialogue, which is to bring practitioners from the field to help inform policymakers on any number of different topics. And the topic today is local capacity building. Betsy, it's really great to have you. Thank you for coming in. Thanks for all of your help in helping us put this together, which I think is going to be very interesting, of both senior policymakers and senior development practitioners talking about one of the central issues of development, which is about local capacity building. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on how local capacity building gets done and what you think the future holds for local capacity building.
Well, thank you, first of all, Dan. I think it's really fantastic that you have, you know, visualized this session and are bringing together these two disparate groups, because we actually need to be talking to each other much more, the, you know, field practitioners and different kinds of field practitioners, and then with policymakers, that there's been really a chasm, if you will, between these two groups. And yet a lot of the evidence for the policymakers comes from the field practitioners, and that without that evidence, there really isn't the opportunity to form the kind of policy that is going to be realistic and achieve good outcomes. And so I just really want to applaud you for that. In terms of your question, which is huge and broad, but, you know,
you can pick and choose within that.
Okay, thanks. I mean, it's a favorite subject of anybody who's in development, because really at the end of the day, you know, that's what we're doing. We are trying to build capacity to do new things. And we can get really boxed up in kind of, you know, well, what really is capacity building? But we know that at the end of the day, the metric of success is, you know, can this thing carry on because you've, you know, catalyzed a new idea and created the capability, usually in a common birthing process.
Are you a former health officer?
I think at the end of the day, we actually are midwives. And I was thinking, you know, midwifing something new. And I think it's a conundrum in development because, you know, what does ownership mean in that context when you are midwifing something new? I mean, it's partly you're helping to give birth to a possibility that you're not going to necessarily realize in the long term, and it's a bit like giving birth to a child. I mean, you know, you watch it go, you nurture it, you let it kind of follow its passions, and, you know, you enable it to do things that, frankly, you are amazed they actually end up doing, because it's not what you may have fully predicted, but it is still a part of you. Anyway, you know, not to wax too mom in all of this, I think that there is a lot of that in development, and that it's something that the donors really have to come to grips with, because a lot of times I have found myself responding to an RFP that really doesn't have national ownership. The national entities that are expected to benefit from it, or government or what have you, really are not knowledgeable about it. And I'm often in a situation where I'm really kind of helping to create understanding and commitment behind this idea. And then to take it the next step and say, all right, you guys, how could we do this really well here? What would it look like to be able to make a real difference for you, that you would see this as being particularly well done here, that you could see lots of different organizations getting on board with, and that would really make an impact and a difference for you as well as what the vision is of the donor. So we really, in that process, help to create the ownership that I think the donors often really want. And then I think we do capacity building on so many different levels. And one of my favorite levels is working with the local private sector. I love working with the local private sector and saying, okay, in the long term, they will have the capacity by doing this work, which sometimes we mentor them to do, but they will have the capacity to go forward and provide those services into the future for these kinds of activities. But that's really just one, you know, of many ways that you could approach capacity building. I think a lot of times, too, people so quickly jump to the idea, it's training. Well, you know, one, it's not, but two, I think we all have a very limited view of what training is. Like right now, I'm involved in capacity building for 26 NGOs, which have gone through a self-assessment process, and they have defined really areas that they need assistance in, and we've also sieved it against what USAID will need them to be able to do to directly fund them. So we're kind of from both ends. But our capacity building, the so-called training, it's applied training. They come in, they have to create something that they'll take back and refine and finish in their own organizations. And then we have a whole sort of system of mentoring and support through a help desk that will help them through that process. So it's not just that static come in, somebody tells you about something and you walk out. It's a whole way of approaching how you would impart those skills and help to develop them and create the outcome back in an organization. And I think, you know, I want people to think broadly, not narrowly, because when you think narrowly about capacity building, you end up with certain assumptions that are just false.
Yeah, it seems to me there's a lot of shorthand or sort of flippant conclusions that oftentimes I don't think are aligned with reality.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about, there's some urban mythologies out there that I think that are murmured under the people's breaths that I think are out there, but I think it would be powerful and important to dispel, because I certainly don't believe them. But you hear things like, oh, if we support large U.S. entities, whether they're NGOs or in the IDC community, that quote-unquote 90% of those resources are staying in the United States, which I've always found completely, I don't know where this comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, I'll add a sort of an additional wrinkle to that, which is why are we, even if that was true, which I don't believe, why are we measuring this on capacity building only on an inputs basis, which is sort of the other thing, which I think you were getting at earlier about, well, you need to think more broadly than it's just training or money. Mm-hmm. There's a whole series of other things that are being imparted when we think about capacity building.
Right.
So let me put that to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, people get lodged in a mindset about something that was at one time. At one time, about 95% of assistance was, spent in the U.S., okay? Because in the old days, the early days, let's say, of development, the teams were primarily expats. I mean, it was a different view, and it was a different time, and had a different set of requirements. I mean, mostly now, our teams are national. We have very limited inputs of expats. I think the expat input is absolutely critical, because that's where a lot of the new think is going to come from, and you need that leadership. But it's not like the old days where you, and also in the old days, you had a lot of teams that were made up of sort of, quote, resident advisors, and they actually worked in ministries. And today, much less of the assistance is done that way. So, visualize almost any team around the world that I've been involved with, and I've been involved with, scores of projects. I mean, you basically have to visualize a country office, most of the stuff procured locally, staffed by country nationals, with maybe one and max two expats, often TCNs, people who are, and it's third country nationals. I mean, people who are coming from nearby or even far away countries. Latin America actually is a very interesting source of expat leadership, because they're at a different stage in development. And so they're providing very interesting now understanding of the development context that they can then bring to leadership in other regions like Asia and Africa. So I think, today where things are sourced and where the money is going is very different than it was in the old days. But I also really want to come back to your point. What is the importance of that? What exactly is that a measure of? Because What we're doing in a development project is we are bringing in something new and innovative. Wherever that money comes from, it's not so much about where it's being spent as what it achieves. And, you know, like, for example, and I know you and I share a common love of public-private partnerships. I mean, that money is going to be generated locally and spent locally and often dwarfs what you are actually bringing in as the investment from the donor. So I think, again, think rich, think broad, and not get stuck in these little sort of, you know, silos of concern that then tend to formulate a whole policy that actually doesn't achieve what is our objective, which, of course, is good development and, you know, change societies.
Betsy, what a privilege to have you. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to the conversation later
Thank
this
you.
Morning. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to Development Dialogues, brought to you by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. For more on economic development from CSIS, including our latest audio, video, and publications, subscribe on iTunes U, visit uslid.csis.org, or download the CSIS iPhone app.